This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. 5 years ago, the streets of New York City were full of the sounds of outrage and protest. The city was reacting to the killing of Eric Garner in Staten Island.
I can't breathe! I can't breathe!
I can't breathe! It's denial!
We want a public trial!
No indictment is denial!
We want a public trial!
No. Hands up!
Don't shoot!
Hands up!
Don't shoot!
Hands up!
Don't shoot!
This is not just about Eric Garner. It's about all of us. It's about our collective humanity and what we as Americans are passing on to the next generation of Americans.
I'm disgusted and embarrassed by our New York City government and NYPD.
I was doing everything peacefully, but it's gotten to the point where
you gotta keep the peace.
It's wrong.
I know.
We all are hurt.
It's like, where are we headed for? What's the future for me?
Your system died right along with Eric Garner.
The man's life was taken for misdemeanor action. For selling cigarettes, loose cigarettes, you're going to lose your life over that? Come on, it had to have been a better way.
It means people should respect the police officers even more so now, maybe out of fear. Because it seems as we're becoming a police state.
No justice, no peace. No justice, no peace. No justice, no peace.
A now infamous video showed Eric Garner surrounded by police and yelling, "I can't breathe," 11 times while New York City police officer Daniel Pantaleo placed him in a chokehold. Garner then collapsed and died. Yesterday, the Department of Justice, under the direction of Attorney General Bill Barr, announced that it would not press federal charges against Officer Pantaleo.
I am very angry. I stand here in the spirit of my sister, who fought for justice until her dying day for my father, standing outside protesting. I'm going to stand outside and I'm going to scream it. Pantaleo needs to be fired. Eric died 7/17/14. 5 years later and there's still no justice.
The anguish and pain of Emerald Garner, daughter of Eric Garner. She was responding yesterday to the news from the Department of Justice. Eric Garner's death was among the many high-profile killings of unarmed Black Americans that helped reignite Black activism nationwide and demands for police reform. But in those 5 years, while so much has changed, so much also hasn't.
It's absolutely not surprising to me that the criminal system of injustice is not giving any justice to the family of Eric Garner. It's not unintentional. This is kind of how the system was designed and points to the need for transformative approaches to engaging.
That's Malina Abdullah, the chair of the Department of Pan-African Studies at California State University, Los Angeles, and a co-founder of the Los Angeles chapter of Black Lives Matter. She joined me along with Charlene Carruthers, a community organizer and founding national director of Black Youth Project 100, and Wesley Lowery, national reporter at The Washington Post, for a conversation about where we are today when it comes to the fight for Black lives.
5 years later, Gwen Carr, Eric Garner's mother, is still having to fight these legal and technical battles. And so these are processes that while we discuss, like, the macro, there's still, I think sometimes there's we make a mistake in forgetting the micro, that for individual families, they're still fighting the actual same battle, even as there's been some progress in at a bigger and a larger level.
Charlene, what about you? Is this where you thought we would be 5 years after Eric Garner?
The unfortunate reality is that this is a long, protracted struggle. And our generation or era of people who are fighting for Black liberation, we're not the first group to do it. We're not the first generation to do it. Our ancestors have been in the struggle now. And this marks even the 400th year. This marks the year of return for so many people who are descendants of the transatlantic slave trade back to the continent of Africa. And so we have to ground ourselves in that 5 years. While so much can happen in 5 years, we can see massive escalation in activity on the streets, both locally, regionally, and nationally, that it's 5 years within a long-term struggle. And when we're talking about, I'm going to lean into what Wesley just shared about the how it impacts folks on a very individual level, and talking about Eric Garner's daughter and how she died at the age of 27 of a heart attack. And she was a new mother at the time. And so the struggle for Black lives includes the ways in which our people experience violence in so many ways, from the state or the government, from corporations, and within our communities, and even within our own families. It's a wide web of what this fight is for.
We're having this conversation just hours after the news, as you mentioned, Wesley, of Eric Garner and prosecutors deciding not to charge the New York City police officer who killed him by chokehold. I'm curious, what does this mean for the broader fight for police accountability when it comes to the death of Black men and women?
Well, I think that when we think back 5 years, a lot of the conversation, and this wasn't a new conversation 5 years ago, but many of the people who became involved in it or who became mobilized by whether it be Eric Garner's death or Michael Brown's death may have been new to the conversation. And certainly the like broad consciousness of this discussion reached people who otherwise hadn't been engaged. And so at the time, if you remember, there was a lot of conversation around, well, if the officers did anything wrong, then the system certainly is going to punish them, right? There was this assumption that the system and the processes worked to secure justice for Black and Brown people and for victims of police violence. And what we've seen now time and time again is that that's not how the system is structured. It's not a system that is built to bring police officers to any type of legal justice if and when they kill people. But I think that, and you know, I hear this as I talk to activists and organizers, and I'd be really interested to see what my fellow panelists think here, is that you can't make this conversation solely about whether or not criminal charges are brought against a police officer, right? Because again, as we know, the standard is so high and that these systems were not set up to bring these officers to justice, that time and time again, if that's what people are pushing for or working for, they're going to be disappointed and become either further, you know, become further disillusioned. And rather, there has to be a discussion about what justice looks like broadly and how, if under the current system, people are not receiving the outcomes that they think are fair and equitable, what is the new system that has to be constructed and what does that look like?
I heard some there. Who wants to weigh in?
We're not imagining that the system is going to bring justice. And it really does a disservice to the families who are directly impacted, as well as the memories of those who've been killed, to say, you know, we want justice for Ezell Ford, or we want justice for Trayvon Martin, because you can't get justice for them because their bodies have already been stolen, right? But what we are hoping for is that we'll transform the system in such a way that it'll mean that my son's life will be better protected. So it's important for us to uplift that families know that going in. Most of the families that we work with in Black Lives Matter, we have pretty candid conversations with them about the chances of officers even being prosecuted, let alone convicted. And so they're not really looking for that. Where I think justice comes from is in the struggle. And so this idea that we've always been in struggle, Black people have always struggled for our own liberation, there's a sense of justice that's earned by awakening ourselves to our own power. So when we think about what's happening in terms of the pushback and what we're seeing with this current administration, the surge in, they call it hate, but it's really white supremacist violence, right? Which is meted out both in rhetoric, policy, and actual physical violence, especially towards Black people. I think it reminds folks that we have to continue to rise up. And while we don't get the same media coverage that we got 5 or 6 years ago, we also have to recognize the tremendous will of the people and being willing to stand up and engage in lots of different ways.
I think perhaps one of the biggest, the most prominent memories of that I have was, Wesley, you and I being in Ferguson. Of course, I was there very briefly. You were there for extended amounts of time covering and are still covering the unraveling of the Michael Brown case years later. And part of what we witnessed there was boots on the ground, demonstrations, tear gas, rubber bullets. Are we not seeing that kind of activism anymore?
I actually think that there's a ton of activism that it looks like all types of different things, right? Even back then in 2014, 2015, it wasn't just the people in the streets, although mm-hmm. that certainly drew our attention, in us being the media and the kind of the country writ large. Although I will state that there certainly have been sizable demonstrations and protests that have happened in any number of cities very recently. But that said, I do think that sometimes we have to like unweave the extent to which like we assume that if we are no longer paying attention to a thing, that thing is no longer happening or going on, right? And so what we know to be true is that the police are still killing people, right? There are three fatal police shootings every single day in the United States of America. That's the exact same rate it was in 2014 and 2015 and 16 and 17 and 18. And so it's not as if racism in policing has been solved and there are no longer any issues within police use of force, right? What we know is that many of the organizations and activists and organizers who were doing the work in 2014 and 15 and 16 and got a ton of attention were doing that work before we had shown up to tell some of these stories or before the shootings were being captured on cell phone video or being live tweeted, and that many of them are still, many of them in an additional set of folks are still doing that work now. And so I do think that, you know, we're living in a moment where we are dealing with a lot of distraction and noise that's coming out of Washington. I also think that I was just thinking about this yesterday, that so much of our conversation in the national media was framed around how President Obama, the first black president, would handle these types of issues. And so that created a different staying power in the national conversation than there is in this moment, where there's the assumption that President Trump isn't going to do anything and certainly isn't going to come out and try to address things. But I also think that sometimes it speaks to how fickle we can be sometimes. When a police shooting does make it through and does get into kind of the national conversation, I get emails from readers who say, didn't we solve this already? Didn't we deal with this in 2014? There's the sense that like we had a conversation and that conversation ended, like it had a bookend. But the reality is this is like a long-term grapple and a long-term struggle. And it's not something that like, all right, well, we all watched that one video. And so we bought a mm-hmm. bunch of body cameras and now like policing is fixed, right? This mm-hmm. is something that has been a struggle that's been going on since the beginning of American policing and is something that certainly wasn't fixed by 2 or 3 years of protest. And I don't think any of the organizers or activists or people in the streets thought it was going to be fixed in those individual moments.
Charlene, what's your assessment of the national attention and specifically the media attention on police killings of people of color and specifically unarmed black Americans?
Well, I agree with so much of what Wesley said, that the media is absolutely fickle when it comes to the stories that are actually, that the stories that receive attention. I can recall maybe one time a reporter ever asked to film a meeting, which is where we spend most of our time. We spend most of our time in planning meetings, figuring out what we're going to do. And the tip of the iceberg is the action that you may hear about that happens on the street. Underneath that are a series of strategy meetings, meals, conversations, relationship building. All kinds of work happens outside of what people see on the street.
Melina, I want to step back for a moment because I remember attempting to pitch a story early on about Black Lives Matter and its importance and sort of being shut down very early on in the movement's birth, if you will. And here we are years later. When we think about where Black Lives Matter as a movement is today, how would you assess it?
Thinking about Black Lives Matter, so we were born July 13th, 2013, right here in Los Angeles, and we've been engaging ever since. We are getting, you know, very little media coverage, but I think in cities like Los Angeles, we've really grown. And we have demonstrations at least 3 times a week. And as Charlene lifted up, the demonstrations are only the tip of the iceberg. We have had an impact on how our community is policed. If we think about the numbers, yes, people are still being killed by police. However, in the cities where we have the most active Black Lives Matter chapters and the most active organizing work, we've seen numbers drop. So in Los Angeles, at the start of Black Lives Matter, there were over 20 people being killed each year by police, by LAPD. And now we're down to about 7 or 8 folks being killed a year. Now, that's not justice. Justice would mean no killings at the hands of LAPD. But it is an impact.
I want to ask both Charlene and Melina if you can weigh in on this. I mean, we talked a little bit, Charlene, you brought up Erica Garner's death, untimely death in her 20s. And I think this is part of a bigger conversation about fatigue, exhaustion, if you will, in the movement and among activists who are front and center trying to do these direct actions. And Melina, you faced even criminal charges as a result of your activism because of that. I mean, what toll does that take on the movement or movements as a whole?
And thinking about how individual people are impacted by this, people have to know the scale at which people are impacted. It's not just the most visible leaders. It is our folks who are in chapters across the country. BYP 100 is in four states in the South, in the Midwest, and on the East Coast as well. And our local leaders. Our local leaders carry so much of the burden of the work on a day-to-day basis. And it's absolutely exhausting work. And we are working under capitalism. We are working under anti-blackness and working under systems of patriarchy. And so we have to do the work to always tell as big of stories as possible about what's happening on the ground. And those stories have to include the dozens, hundreds of people who are moving this work. And so I think one of the reasons why you don't see people in the streets in the same way every single day now is because people are choosing to and being required to do their work differently, because it takes a toll on your physical, mental, and spiritual self. And for those of us who have decided that this is a lifetime commitment, we have to understand that it is not a sprint. And frankly, it's not just a marathon where we just keep going. If anything, it may be a relay race. It may be a way to think about it, where we're like the baton is passed back and forth through many people as we go along the journey. And so we have to make those types of commitments to actualizing what some people will call healing justice in our movements as we develop strong leaders to do this work, because it goes beyond any individual's lifetime, and the individual also matters in the work.
I want to pivot for a second because we are running short on time here, but we are heading into a very contentious election season. We've been in a very contentious political cycle now for quite some time. I recall going into the 2016 election, candidates, particularly Democratic candidates, were talking a lot about even using the language of Black Lives Matter in particular. I'm not hearing similar language so far. It's still very early in the debates. There's still 20 some odd candidates. But I'm wondering, Wesley, as you cover these movements and as we look ahead to 2020, is the tone different? Are the presidential candidates addressing these specific issues as they relate to Black Americans?
Well, I think the conversation has shifted. I do think that a wide array of candidates have adapted language and positions that were unthinkable even 4 or 5 years ago, and that there is credit to the activists and organizers who've done that. So when you think about 2016, there was a massive like rhetorical fight over whether or not like Hillary Clinton would even say the words Black Lives Matter. And now you have presidential candidates rolling out plans for racial reparations, right? We live in a completely different world than we did 4 or 5 years ago. You had a candidate in Julian Castro invoke specifically the crisis facing Black trans women. You have people like Elizabeth Warren who are talking specifically about maternal mortality rates among Black women, right? These are conversations that are, and talking points and policy issues that have been adapted specifically from young Black organizers. And again, there's a level of specificity there where you have 3 or 4 or 5 candidates out there with specific policing plans, when previously it would have been considered like radical and hyper-liberal and progressive to even admit that perhaps the police needed to change or something needed to be different. And so I think that the last few years of movement have unquestionably changed the way certainly Democratic candidates, but I would argue even some Republican candidates, talk about these issues at all, and the depth to which they engage those issues. And it's hard to sometimes it's hard to remember how far we've come as it relates to those things. And so that gets lost sometimes. I mean, is that enough? Is it, you know, I don't think it's like, I don't think this is something that's static. Well, all right, you've checked the right box, you've said the right thing, and so therefore you can stop caring about Black people or brown people or about activist movements. Like, there's always going to be pressure, and that pressure is always going to force folks to consider things they haven't otherwise. But I think that when you look at the 2020 election cycle and the 2016 election cycle, we live in a world that is far beyond where it was at the time, and that's because of the way so many activists and organizers have been able to begin shifting and changing this conversation.
Wesley Lowery is a national reporter at The Washington Post. Charlene Carruthers is a community organizer and founding national director of Black Youth Project 100. And Melina Abdullah is chair of the Department of Pan-African Studies at California State University, Los Angeles, and a co-founder of the Los Angeles chapter of Black Lives Matter. Thanks to you all for this robust and interesting conversation.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Hi, my name is Janelle, calling from Miami, and I used to protest against police brutality when I was in school at Howard University, and we used to protest all the time. We even once witnessed an undercover cop shoot a man. Now that I'm older, I have a toddler right now, so my protests now are used for social media. That's as much as I can do right now until my toddler grows up. He's going to be growing up as a Black male in the United States, so I'll most likely be protesting again until things change.
This is Andrea Hollingsworth. I'm calling from Lancaster, Texas. I had never participated in this type of a protest, but I was inspired by my 16-year-old daughter who basically said we can't sit on the sidelines when these types of things are happening.
I did not protest actively until about 2 years ago. Since then, I've been working with an organization in Tacoma that helps formerly incarcerated people return to life outside. And from those people, I have learned the gut-wrenching stories of what it is like to be Black in American cities, particularly when the police are involved.
This is Lorna Lynn calling from Wynwood, Pennsylvania. I participated in a march for Black Lives Matter in a nearby suburb of Philadelphia a few years ago. This was well organized and respectful. Local police were in attendance to help with blocking off traffic. Many of us took time to thank the police for being there. My sense was that these police officers were troubled by the violent behavior that others in their profession had shown towards Black citizens.
Hi, my name is Alita. I'm calling from Normal, Illinois. I am a 57-year-old white woman. I have lobbied for a local citizens advisory board to bridge the gap between citizens and the local police force. My book group has read White Fragility by Robin DiAngelo and other books about the history of civil rights and racism in the U.S. I follow the Twitter accounts of Black writers, artists, scholars, and politicians because I want to know their perspectives. In conversations with other white people, I try to explain and transmit what I keep learning from Black thinkers and activists.
This is The Takeaway. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE to comment on any story or give us your thoughts on any topic. Also, we're on Facebook and Twitter at The Takeaway. Let us know what you think, and thanks for listening.